Hello and welcome to Lot Awful Movies. This is the big 5-0, Andrew. We've hit that.
Did
we're
we do
over
something
hill.
Special for our half centennial?
I didn't kind of plan
feels like
anything.
We should.
Oh, hold on. Wait a minute. I did. Welcome Heath Enright to the call. How are you doing, Heath?
I'm doing fan-fucking-tastic. This is Lamb 5-0.
Yep.
Yeah.
Excellent. Very excited. I'm going to do like a 50 style review of this now. I'm going to amp it up.
All right.
We watched The Trial of the Chicago 7, which is written and directed for some reason by Aaron Sorkin. And I am notoriously not a fan. So anyway, Andrew, what were your thoughts on watching this movie?
So I hate this trend in like recent movie making where you've taken a supremely interesting story,
yes,
right? Like The Trial of the Chicago 7 is an amazingly interesting story.
Absolutely.
I got lost down so many rabbit trails, like researching, did that really happen? And like they told it in a way that is objectively less interesting and worse.
Yeah.
I just don't
true.
Get
yeah.
it. So,
absolutely
so, I mean,
true.
Like, The model should be, I think Heath, you're with me on this, the model should be Casino, right?
Like, sure, yeah.
Casino was
wait,
super,
is that a real story?
Oh, yeah. That's, yeah. It's like even that. the stupidest part of Casino, right? Nobody knew that that my car had a metal plate under the driver's seat that you're like, well, that's super fucking convenient. That's a real story that
wow.
really happened to the real dude that Robert De Niro's character is based on, right? So like, that's an example of like spectacular storytelling. I guess what I want to say is this is the anti-Casino.
Okay.
any opening thoughts from you there, Heath?
Okay, well, first of all, I will be vociferously defending Aaron Sorkin throughout. I love Aaron Sorkin, but I get it. Listen, I get it. So, like, I used to just completely unabashedly love Aaron. I used to think he was, like, the best writer. Now I'm aware that he's not the best writer, but I still think he's great. Like, everything's contrived, but I love how it's contrived.
Oh, man.
So, this movie is, like, as always, it's Aaron Sorkin winning an argument with himself in his head because he's smarter than himself, number
yeah.
two, because he's great. But it's so it's still great. Like, The West Wing's contrived, but it's fantastic. I get it. There are obvious flaws. We're going to talk
that's
about
fair.
Them.
Yeah.
How many Democratic politicians over the last 20 years do you think, like, fucked themselves into a corner thinking, like, oh, man, all I have to do is the kind of shit that Aaron Sorkin's characters do on screen, and this will work great. And you're like, oh, no, wait, this doesn't work at all if you're talking to an actual, like, other person engaged in the argument.
I think you just need Josh and Toby and you're set. I think that's real. I think that part of the West Wing is real.
All right. Well, I hope you won't take any personal offense at my hit. Here's what I'll say. Okay. There's some good stuff in the movie, but the problem is the stuff that's bad because it's so manipulative and gimmicky. When it doesn't work, it's like, oh, fuck you for trying to do that. Like, if there's a, and that might just be a me thing, but I resent how gimmicky and like manipulative the dialogue is. There are times, and I have pages of yelling. I'm going to try to not do. I'll try to do a few pages of it. He does stuff that's like, I feel like Purred Happily, where he does stuff that was in the cadence of a good argument. So, but it's not like you break down what they said and you're like, none of it makes any fucking sense. Like, he thinks he made genius points to each other, but if you broke down what that actually is, it's so fucking stupid for characters to say it to each other and it made no sense that I resent it. So that's cards on the table. I resent it.
There's a character that Aaron Sorkin creates that that makes me supremely angry. And we'll talk about
okay. it. I also came to the conclusion, I wasn't actually aware of this. There's not enough Aaron Sorkin hate on the internet. I thought that I would be able to Google,
really?
I guess I need to start a YouTube channel. I thought I'd be able to Google or whatever and find, like, here's the reasons that Sorkin sucks and all the stuff he does is the same thing. But there's like two things. Not enough people are mad about this. But
there's
I found some good.
There's an entire podcast making fun of the West Wing
oh,
being
good.
Not as good as everybody
what
thinks.
Is,
I think it's called the West Wing Thing or something like that.
Okay.
I've heard it make some good points, actually.
I will bookmark that for later. But I did find some good, like, trope terms for them. There's, like, deadpan snarkers, world of snark, snark to snark combat. Let's see. Oh, this is another trope is the character filibuster. I was just looking at the tropes to try to find, like, yeah, what are the names of some of these things? The character filibuster is my favorite Sorkinism, where somebody just talks for 4 hours and nobody else in the room is like, feels like trying to get a word in. Like, it's just like, somebody just makes a long ass argument.
They do that in court here, which is extra ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay. Let's start the.
All right, let's get into it.
Lyndon Johnson,
yep,
the face of the Democratic Party, and the guy who killed Kennedy, maybe. Yeah,
the guy who definitely did not kill Kennedy.
Probably killed Kennedy.
I love Lyndon Johnson. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where you have to be like, well, you know, except for the whole Vietnam War thing. But we've got the montage of montages to sort of set this up. We see Lyndon Johnson and increases in the draft, and then Kennedy killed and Martin Luther King killed.
I was just catching little snippets of this montage. The draft lottery thing was weird to me. So my dad actually described that. He was at the age where you might get drafted to Vietnam, and the lottery thing came up and his birthday and it mattered and he got whatever number. Who decided the draft lottery needed to be more like a game show?
Yeah.
Like, that was a dick. Like, somebody was like, all right, what if we send the poor kids to war with Plinko? That'll make it exciting, yeah, right?
They do. They are, like, putting the tags up on the board like it's a Price is Right game. It's definitely.
Yeah, don't have the blululip. Like, just don't add the sound effects.
Yeah. There should be one that's like a Joker, and then, like, Lyndon Johnson gets to pick a kid to send to death. Like, oh, President's choice. Okay, you go die.
No whammies. Stop.
And also, we cannot leave scene one without talking about Tom Hayden. I don't know who the actor is.
Eddie Redmayne.
Making the accelerationist argument in front of his, like, school campus. And I just wrote down, like, man, this argument was super fucking stupid back in 1968, wasn't
God
it?
God, like, damn it. Yeah. But we hear them say, Hubert Humphrey, he's basically the same as Richard Nixon. That's unacceptable. And I was like, yeah, that's great. There's no chance of that backfiring. I can't imagine this could possibly backfire, you fucking idiots.
But are we into our Austin Powers intro? This is my favorite thing, because we go into the Austin Powers intro where they go into like, Johnson, you know, he's like, we're going to meet that violence with boobs, you know, or whatever the Austin, you know, that what they did in the Austin Powers movie, whenever there's a giant dick on the radar, and they each had a different, like, Johnson Richard thing.
Right.
They do that for some reason. Like, there's no reason to do this here, because it's just like completing each sentence with a non sequitur, kind of. That one of the other Chicago 7 or 8 is going to say. Weird.
I will add, the only Oscar nod this movie deserved, in my view, was Sacha Baron Cohen as Abby Hoffman.
It's
really, really good. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I expected 4 hours of material about his bad accent, but okay. Because I love Sacha Baron Cohen. I thought he did a good job with a terrible accent. And I was going to be the one that's like, I don't really care that his accent sucked. It didn't really matter to me. But like,
a bad Boston accent is better in a movie. Like, you just overdo it. Do it badly. It's so much better. It's hilarious.
Okay. I'm glad we're on the same page there. I love Sacha Baron Cohen.
He accidentally slips into Kennedy accent a few times too, which is great. Start talking about like Martin Luther King Jr. No, okay, sorry. No, I'm ready. I'm Southie Boston. I was doing
he
it
chose to go to the moon in this decade. Yeah.
Also, we get Jerry Rubin apparently teaching bombs as a he was a professor of Molotov cocktails. Where was that? Maybe college, or maybe it was just a classroom
ready to go to the Chicago stuff, right?
Okay.
It'd be pretty weird.
Did you get it? Yeah, I definitely thought of it as just like, this is his normal classroom duties. But, you know, it's like, sign up with the TA if you need to figure out, like, you know, where to get the bottle from. And
this is just like normal Berkeley stuff in 1968.
But I have to say, I also, do you guys watch Succession? I know Andrew doesn't because he doesn't watch good things. Heath, do you watch Succession?
No.
Oh, it's a great show. You should check it out. Strong Succession recommendation. Jeremy Strong from Succession playing Jerry Rubin. I'll toss an olive branch, even though this is very not accurate to Jerry Rubin, because like Jerry Rubin went on to be like a super rich, successful finance guy. You know, like he's not a bumbling stoner idiot, but it's fine. You know, you play the archetype for laughs. And I think this is where Sorkin's best work in this movie was, because for me anyway, I found the Jerry Rubin character pretty funny. So I thought it was good.
Yeah. Oh, he was very funny. Yeah. Absolutely.
Love that actor.
We also, really quick, we get to see the Black Panthers HQ during this montage. And it's just like a normal office, and they do a perfect Sorkin walk and talk yeah. around yep. this yep. office. Yes, and it's just all normal office stuff, but everything has guns and bullets in it. So there's like the inbox outbox, but it's just like a rack of bullets. And like... a computer screen with a gun sticking out somehow.
It's a water cooler, but like the cup dispenser is guns, you know, that comes out of the...
instead of petty cash box, they have a petty gun box.
I like that. Oh, nice. Oh. That's only for like small time, you know, Black Panther murdering or whatever the heck Sorkin thinks this is about. But I love we get the Sorkin-esque walk and talk where we have to have the two characters arguing because there isn't a scene unless two characters are arguing for Aaron Sorkin. That's just what a scene is for him. Like, he literally has said that. Like, that's a scene for him. But anyway, we have the girl, and I love this because there's only, I don't know, three female characters who speak in this entire movie, and this one has to be the Black Panther. Like, you know, she's at the headquarters of the Black Panther, but she's like, no, don't go to Chicago. What character is that? There's like, no, don't give a speech in Chicago. I hear that in the future that bad things happened there in the past or something. I don't know what, what would she be saying that for? I don't even understand it. And then we get this good interruption part where they finish each other's lines in a different way, which is another Sorkinism. And she's like, but Dr. King, and he says, is dead. He had a dream. Well, now he has a fucking bullet in his head. And now Moses is dead and Robert Kennedy is dead. Jesus is dead. He goes through this monologue. And then she says, like, we'll take a gun with you. And he says, if I knew how to use that, I wouldn't be giving speeches. What does any of that mean? Does it?
I know.
That's most of Sorkin
for me. That long silence you hear. Yeah, no, but, yeah, but you're right.
That had the cadence. Of a joke, yeah. You know, like it, but that's not anything.
I wanted her to stop and be like, hey, did you notice that, like, we always have snappy things to say and finish each other's sentences? Like, we keep doing sentences. Oh, you're going to say sentences. Wow. All right.
Yeah, they're like, yeah. We've just walked around this tiny office four times. Like, we could have just stopped in the middle, had a conversation. All right.
Can we go back the other direction? It's just like circling.
He looks at his Fitbit. He's like, I just need to get, you know, it's telling me I need to get the steps in. Hold on. Sorry. I got to. Go around the room a few more times.
Oh, I would love to see a Sorkin walk and talk where they're on like treadmills and you don't realize it at first.
All right, we can move on in.
But you are correct though that this movie does not pass the Bechdel test and does God, not come no. close.
No,
right?
It doesn't like, attempt the Bechdel test. No. It took the test sheet of paper and ate it and left the classroom. It didn't even.
Yeah. In fairness, 1968 fails the Bechdel test.
Well, that's but does it though, or is that just
well?
Because...
No, not in reality. Yeah. But yes, well, stories about it, history about it.
Yeah, exactly.
As written, by dudes. Yeah.
So now we get to meet the prosecutors, and so we cut on over to incoming Attorney General John Mitchell, and this is where we're introduced to, in my view, the most angrifying part of this movie.
What? You didn't like the conservative with a heart of gold lawyer?
I like Joseph Gordon-Levitt as an actor. I like the idea of this as a character. But the part that he's playing, it is just 100% revisionist history to put any of this in his mouth. Like, he's playing an asshole prosecutor who – he's playing Richard Schultz, right? Dick Schultz. And he was the, like, hotshot, hyper-aggressive prosecutor. Everybody who's covered this trial for real has said he was just a cutthroat lawyer, right? Mm-hmm. Like that none of the thing, including the most important scene in the first act of the or second act of the movie, you know, is put at his feet to make, because, you know, you got to love Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I don't know.
His
boss, hyper-homophobic went on, like, several when you read the transcripts, like, went on several, like, anti-gay tangents in cross-examination during the actual trial. And, like,
you could have put that in.
That's super fucking interesting, right? Like, you're playing this as good versus evil. Like, why did
it is the weirdest
whitewash
thing.
That out? I don't
know. I want to know what he thinks about this. Why would – okay. Is it that maybe Sorkin was worried about being too black and white thinking, like, simple? You know, would it be too cartoon villain to have just portrayed the fact that these attorneys probably actually were just cartoon villains? You know, like, they were that bad. Was he thinking it would be, like – that would look too hacky. So he puts in Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who I agree, I think he performed it well and did everything he could and is interesting on screen. But the character makes no fucking sense, and it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't into the story that he's got a heart of gold. It doesn't do anything anywhere. He tries to kind of make it sort of work later, but it doesn't. It's such a minor thing that we'll get to. So why do that? What is the fucking point of that?
I think it's just Sorkin doing that thing where he wants there to be like, oh, I see the nuance in everything when I have arguments in my head against myself. And so he wants it to be like, oh, look how the smart characters in this all start to slowly understand each other. And this is like the one guy from that side that's going to be part of that.
But in terms of the artificial bullshit of this scene, Andrew, we get for some reason, the other guy hasn't told Joseph Gordon-Levitt what he's even doing there when he's about to meet the new attorney general. Like, what?
Yeah, we had to keep this under wraps because, you know, we wouldn't want to spoil it for the audience. Like, it's
so dumb.
It's super fucking dumb.
Oh, and the monologue before. Okay, we get introduced to this character who's the guy from The Wire. He's a great old actor. I almost thought it's not Hank from Breaking Bad, but close. It's almost that guy.
Yeah.
But I confused them, but it's because they're both in great stuff. This guy's in The Wire, I think.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Yeah.
He's angry old white guy.
Yeah. Who kind of looks like Hank from Breaking Bad, but not. And we do. Oh, this is another Sorkinism. The fucking monologue before the introduction. So, like, the guy you don't know walks in, you're like, do you know when fucking what's his fuck to hand it in his resignation letter?
And then he does. Are you in the middle of a speech? Are you halfway?
I can come in again.
Were you talking before we walked in to yourself?
It's a custom for the president's previous cabinet to all hand in their this is seriously how he starts the scene. To all hand in their resignation letters. But what's his name waited till an hour before my confirmation to do it. Seems like a hell of an embarrassment to me, but more like an embarrassment to him. Hi, I'm something something. Like, he pretty much goes into that.
I would like to make a list of my enemies. You know what? No, okay, you're here. We'll talk now. I was doing a speech to myself.
He seriously drops into the like, hi, I'm Troy McClure after that. You know? The only acceptable, I'll give you one line. You know, something like, they should all be destroyed. And then do an introduction. You know what I mean? Like, that's a strong... I was hoping Heath had the Jurassic Park appreciation that I do. But like, that's the strong. I'll give you one line of like quick exposition-y character stuff as you're being introduced in a scene, like, say, they should all be destroyed about the dinosaurs that you're talking about. But like a whole monologue where it's like, it's a 5-paragraph essay, and then you end with like you restate your thesis and your conclusion, and then you go, hi, I'm, you know, my name is something something.
Okay, it's so weird. We can start the scene now. We're in an office. Should we walk and talk? Because we're in an office this small. All right, we'll start. So that was stupid, but I was more offended by this one thing at the end of his speech than anything else, when he was like, let's all drink some Johnny Walker. Yeah. And I was like, come on, man. Yeah, you're supposed to be like the class. You have good scotch. And he's like, yeah, it's Johnny Red. Everybody loves this. He's the best. Fuck you.
I had that same note.
Well, the other thing he said, there are times when I think Sorkin just didn't finish writing this, but just was like, fine, that's fine. He says, so after that intro monologue, he says, Richard, because he's talking to, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Richard, Chicago is more fucked up than any 10 things I've ever seen in my life. Huh. That's the line. I went
back.
So the second, the second time through, I watched it with subtitles and made sure to like diligently transcribe these sentences because I want to prove how fucking stupid they are. They're Chicago is more fucked up than any 10 things I've ever seen in my life. It just doesn't. What? What? Why would you say that? Was that a thing someone would say? It's 10 times as fucked up as any other city. I don't know. Say something like that.
There you go.
It's almost. It's 70% of the Zaphod Beeblebrox line in which he says, don't try it out, weird me. Like, I get things stranger than you free with my breakfast cereal. Right? Which is such a much better line, right? Like, anyway.
Oh, but that's the feeling I have is that it's always 70% of something told in the cadence of a thing, but it's not a thing. And it drives me nuts.
Real law thing here. John Mitchell instructs Joseph Gordon-Levitt to go, you know, get them under conspiracy, and he cites 18 U.S.C. 2101. They call it something else. This was actually a
Wraparound law?
Yeah. I that as far as I can tell is never what it's been called. It was a part of the Civil Rights Act of 1965. It is an anti-rioting statute. And then they do this thing and I just don't understand it. And I know it only drives me nuts. Like, I'm literally the only person in America that cares about
this. Give
me
a chance.
Right? No. Okay. Well, I will. But Mitchell says it's got a 10-year max and we want all 10. And so look, like, on the one hand, you actually could have that line in 1969 because there weren't the federal sentencing guidelines yet. But weirdly, 18 U.S.C. 2101, they went to the trouble of citing the actual law. It carries a five-year statutory maximum. And at the end of the movie, spoiler, in the Breakfast Club close, like, they'll say, okay, you know, these five defendants got the maximum 5 years. And you're like, well, then why did you have the guy say I want all 10?
I'm so glad you were here to break that down, because when it said they got 5 years, I was like, oh, that's weird. They didn't really give them the full thing. Okay. And I was trying to, like, figure out what that meant. Like, did that mean he did go easy on them? But that's just a fuck up. Like, just how?
Yeah, I don't get it. Yeah,
compromise the movie.
One other legal question on that. So part of the law says if you're guilty of conspiracy to incite violence and you cross state lines, that's a thing that's worse. Why would state lines be part of the rule about inciting violence? I don't understand that.
Because otherwise it couldn't be a federal law.
Yeah.
So otherwise it would just be a state statute.
Oh, right? Okay. So that's why they're in federal court specifically.
Exactly right. Yep.
Just a couple gimmicky things that I have to point out that I hate about this scene. For one, we get Joseph Gordon-Levitt, as you said, his character would have been one of the biggest assholes, if not the biggest asshole. You know, probably second biggest asshole in this room. But instead, he's like the principled opposition. But that makes not a lot of sense when we've decided that the attorney general handpicked this guy to lead the prosecution. Why? So, like, we have this scene of him trying to convince Joseph Gordon-Levitt, like, because Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character is like, this doesn't make sense to me. Like, it doesn't seem like we already ran the investigation under the previous guy and we didn't find any charges. Like, we shouldn't do it. And he's like, I've handpicked you to be the prosecutor. What? How does that make sense? Why would you do that?
We're going to talk about it once we get into the actual trial, but, like, this is another one of those things that, like, internally just collapses the moment you look at it sideways, right? It just – you can't maintain that I'm the principled opposition with respect to what happens in about 4 minutes runtime in the movie. But,
and then there's one more thing. As a state employee, as someone who has worked for the government, I just have to say – we get the line, well, you pay me for my opinion. And I'm like, he doesn't pay you. He's the attorney general. He doesn't pay you. That's not like, unless you're a consultant firm that the government brought in. And even then you wouldn't be like, you pay me. It'd be like, yeah, our budget that we have fucking endless money. Cause we're, you know, the government, if part of it goes toward you. Nobody said, if somebody said that in a government office, like, you pay me for, you'd be like, what are you talking about? Nobody pays anybody in here. The government pays us. God, it's so weird.
One other follow-up. So I just thought of this. You're conspiring to do some violence. Why wouldn't you just cross the state line first and then conspire the violence? Like you make the plans, just like, we're going to Chicago for funsies. And then you're like, we're in Illinois. We're going to fuck up some cops.
Well, if you're going to do that, why not just, like, don't leave evidence behind that you conspired at all?
Great advice for Matt Gaetz. I hope he's listening.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Well, speaking of, we get what I'm calling, and these are all arbitrary scene definitions, but what I'm calling the next scene is clips of the demonstrations in Chicago. So now, you know, everybody has made it there. And my note here is just, we have the chance of the whole world is watching, which is historically accurate.
Okay. But, I have a question about that. Go ahead.
But what it omits, two frustrating things. The first is the reason the whole world is watching is sort of the signature protest chant from the 1968 DNC protest is because they were covered on the evening news extensively. And, like, this movie deliberately omits that part of the story, which is a super duper important part of the story, right? Like, they have this cutaway to, like, Walter Cronkite sort of solemnly saying, like, well, you know, the Democrats are about to nominate their candidate for president in, you know, what can only be described as a police state. And it's like, right, like, it's significant that, like, America's grandpa was saying that on the national news. And we don't get any of that story.
They're chanting "the whole world is watching." I get that. They show us the courthouse steps. And there's like the dueling sides, right? So like somehow, somehow they figured out like, all right, we're on the left side, you're on the right side, and we're yelling at each other. And like they duel it out, but it was hilarious to me because it seemed like the movie was saying they were both chanting "the whole world is watching." So it was like, yeah, the whole world is watching, and the other side was like, yeah, yeah, the whole world is watching. We want them to. Yes, I hope we. I wish that everybody was watching.
Real talk, that would be fucking amazing if there was a protest and one side does the thing, and you just put like a different emphasis on it. So like, yeah, the whole world is watching. And then you guys are like, okay, we're all going to chant, "the whole world is watching." Yeah.
WNBC. Yeah. I always want to see those chants fizzle out too. Because there has to be an end moment. So it goes for, you know, 20 minutes, an hour. I don't know how long, but at some point, everybody's just like, "the whole world's watching." All right.
Yeah, the whole world's watching. And then one person tries to get
it
going again.
The last asshole. Yeah. The last guy that stands up for the wave in the ballpark. Yeah. You know, it's when it looks around.
I might as well use this note now. I had it later when they're chanting "whose streets are streets" for 45 minutes. I would not be a good protester. I just wouldn't. I've been to a few, but I'm not an audience participation guy. I'm just not. I can't do it. Like, so if they're doing "whose streets, our streets, whose street," after 30 seconds I'd be like, okay, we're gonna stop that, right? I can't sit here and listen to this.
you have more material, right?
Okay, so we covered "it's our streets," we got that out. Is there any other points we want to make? They'll just do "whose streets are streets" for 2 hours. I couldn't handle that. I'd have to bring headphones, like noise canceling headphones. I'd be singing.
Okay, one other moment here. Right after we see "the whole world is watching," they walk into the courthouse, and Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, they're going in. Somebody throws an egg, and Jerry Rubin catches it like Mr. Miyagi somehow.
Yeah.
Like somebody, okay, first of all, somebody hard-boiled an egg to throw,
I guess,
one egg.
And then decided to just loft it slowly at him,
right.
Like lob it to him.
Yeah, that was a weird moment. But I found this hilarious. He's like, "so what do I just like carry the egg now?"
That was a good moment. Because and by the way, it is the opposite, right? Like as soon as you see Jerry Rubin with the egg, that's Chekhov's egg, right? Like that egg's going off at some point. Nope, never goes off.
It's no, okay. I was
you better
furious.
At least cook it later or something. You know,
I feel like if it's a hard boiled egg right there, you eat the egg, power move. You just like,
why would it be hard boiled? Why would it be hard boiled? Are you just saying that because he was able to catch it or not?
Did you ever do that summer camp thing where you got like
egg toss?
Further, yeah, right?
Yeah, I can do that. But Jerry Rubin, out of nowhere with no warning, I don't think he was doing that.
No, I agree. But also, if you're going to take an egg to throw at somebody, you're not hard boiling that shit. You want it to splat on him. But yeah, I love too. We get into the courtroom. I also love that Sorkin was like, "well, Fred Hampton is pretty big right now." And Fred Hampton was apparently around this trial and said like a thing or two about it. So Sorkin is like, "well, he is now a star of this courtroom. I'm going to put Fred Hampton everywhere in this trial because he's really big right now, and there's another movie coming out about Fred Hampton."
Yeah, he had some fun moments. Question, Andrew, maybe you know, is there like assigned seating in the courtroom for each squad in the gallery?
And the groom.
Do they, like, they get areas?
This is not good storytelling, right? So, like, at the moment, because you see everybody, like, on the steps and the protesting, and, like, this is the scene in which all of the eight members of the Chicago Eight, and it's really, really important for the storytelling that, like, they don't really know each other that well, right? Like, they're parts of separate groups. And so this should be the fucking arraignment, right? Like,
yeah.
But no, it's day one of the trial, and then we'll have flashbacks to the arraignment, and we'll have flashbacks to jury selection. And it's just like I love Pulp Fiction too, but like there's a reason that linear storytelling has stood the test of time. Like, ugh. But my extreme anger over all of that was slightly mollified by watching Frank Langella walk out as the judge. I love him. He's so good.
Yeah, he does a great job in this.
I assume you have a lot of stuff on this judge, though, Andrew, right? Because this guy was a nightmare. He was born in 1895.
Yeah,
I'd be like, right away, I'd be like, that's not a good job. I don't want, in 1968, if you're like, yeah, the judge over your trial is born in 1895, you'd be like, oh, fuck. All right. I quit. We're screwed. That's a different time.
Has strong opinions about, like, you know, the how bad the passage of the 14th Amendment was. Yeah, no.
Sure hope he's not pro Plessy v. Ferguson, like one of our very recent Supreme Court justices.
Yeah. A reminder, you don't have to be born in 1895 to have shitty opinions.
That's true. No, good point. You can become a chief justice with that opinion recently. Do I have that right? William Rehnquist?
Yeah.
God damn it.
100% correct. Yep. This judge really was super bad in this trial, really was incredibly culturally biased against, you know, long-haired hippies. And so a lot of this shit really did happen. Yeah. He really did hand out, like, ridiculous amounts of contempt orders. And I don't know what it was, though. That seems to me to be such an interesting thing that you could work through. And it just doesn't feel like they do it. In particular, like, this is the pin I wanted you to pull out from Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character. Every ruling this judge, that Judge Frank Langella makes, right, over the course of the next hour and a half is going to be insane, right?
Yeah.
And yet, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's principled opposition is like, well, thank you, Your Honor. May I have another? Right? Like, yeah. It's just right. Like, there's no way to square Joseph Gordon-Levitt's courtroom appearances with everything else the movie is telling you about him. It's so weird.
It's just pointless. It's a pointless character to do, where you're like, what if he was principled? What's going to be the effect of that? Oh, I don't know. He'll just be kind of hesitant in the beginning, and then nothing else will change. And then in the end, he'll stand up, and that'll right. be like the big thing that he stood up yeah. for.
And one more thing, like, we have no shortage of racist things from 1968 that you could point out. You do not have to make up Bobby Seale. By the way, the actor who plays Bobby Seale here is also really good, I think.
Oh, yeah. Pretty much every actor is great in this movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
it made
the movie very watchable.
But he says, yeah, they're out there with signs saying free the Chicago 7 and, like, you know, I'm number 8. And that's fine television and all, except that it was called the Chicago 8 until Bobby Seale was severed from the rest of the case and got a mistrial, right? Like you don't need to make up that the protesters didn't think of him as a person, especially, like, given how super fucking progressive both the SDS and MOB were at the
time.
That
would have been a weird sign to make. If you came with a free the Chicago 7 sign outside the courtroom at that moment, people would be like, hey, dude, what? Like, come on. Are you one of the Nixon people? Like, is this a satire? What are you doing here?
Yeah.
Got to set it up like a gas station marquee with, like, the numbers that you can pull in and out.
Andrew, the beginning of the courtroom scenes here, while we do get some laughs, it basically is like a community meeting where anyone gets to chime in at any time saying anything.
Yeah. I love that Judge Frank Langella keeps fucking it up. He keeps saying stuff that lets the good guys tell jokes right after it, and then he gets mad. So he'll ask him something, and then Abby Hoffman will have this hilarious joke, and he'll be like, stop telling jokes based on the old man stuff I say. And then Joseph Gordon-Levitt at one point has to be like, hey, Judge, I'm a prosecutor. I'm basically on your team. You got to stop teeing up jokes for Abby Hoffman. It's really making us look worse.
And look, the central conflict here on day one, anyway, about Bobby Seale's lawyer not being present, 100% true.
Yeah.
Real fact. And it goes to show you, again, how much cool stuff I think that could have been told in this movie that wasn't. But so that's day one. And then I'm going to arbitrarily call this the next scene where
meeting.
Yeah, the team meeting in the back of the courthouse. And the problem with team meeting here is I just have the note of, no, you can't sit in on this meeting, Bobby Seale's friend.
Yeah, Fred Hampton. I have that too.
Yeah, he just shows, if people from the gallery can just, like, walk around the courthouse and go into rooms sometimes. And he's like, I'm here now.
Well, we do a team meeting, and what I love about this is it's a team meeting where the lawyer does nothing. So, like, the people whose job it is, I get that they chimed in on this trial, you know, from time to time, and they had some funny quips and all that, but there's no way they talked as much as the movie makes it out, but whatever. But, like, the people whose job it is during the trial to sit there and shut up are going to go and discuss the strategy they should be doing, and the lawyer whose job it is to be talking the whole time is going to just be silent. And, like, they're going to talk it out because they're the main characters of the movie. It's so funny.
Yeah, and that will continue throughout the entire movie. But even more so than the like custom and practice, like the moment that Fred Hampton walks into that room, nothing is privileged anymore.
He just pops in. He's like, hey, I'm Fred Hampton, famous Black Panther from history and movies this year that Aaron Sorkin wrote in. I just wanted to say, like, what are you doing here? What?
And it's frustrating because the movie, they've changed this detail for reasons, but like the movie wants to maintain that the main counsel does not represent Bobby Seale.
Well, for some reason, they make it really important to Fred Hampton that Mark Rylance is not representing Bobby Seale. Like, they try.
Yeah.
It's all, again, it's all these like ginned up conflicts. According to the movie, Mark Rylance really wants to represent Bobby Seale, but Bobby Seale's like, no, I have a lawyer. He's just not here because he's in the hospital in Oakland, I think. And then Fred Hampton is like, hey, make sure you're not representing my guy who doesn't have a lawyer here. Like, Fred Hampton walks into their meeting to be like, hey, I know I already said it, but I'm going to interrupt your team meeting here illegally to say, don't represent Bobby Seale because you're not his lawyer. It's like, what? All right.
Sure. And that never pays off.
No, it doesn't matter.
At no point.
Yeah. Don't worry. I am a lawyer, but I have nothing to do with this conversation in here. This is just like a team meeting where we argue with each other. I don't, I'm not even helping. I swear.
Then Mark Rylance is playing William Kunstler, you know, a longstanding, you know, progressive lawyer. He gives his cross-examination while sitting down.
Yeah.
And it's just
power move or not. It's the opposite of a power move. Yeah, I think you want to be up there.
All right. That was it.
One of my favorite history facts is that the real William Kunstler's comb over was even worse than Mark Rylance's. That was just one thing I came across in an article that was like, check out the real picture. It's like even a worse, like they weren't doing a thing with the comb over. Like, it was even worse than that, which I thought was funny. Let's see. So is there any point to this testimony? I mean, is this the guy who talks about the permits forever?
Yeah, the Parks Department guy, right?
Parks Department guy. Yeah.
Right. So apparently he met with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and denied them a permit to have their demonstration in the park. And he's being told to just like say how that meeting went, and we get the flashback to it. But what he would have had to been saying like in court is Abby Hoffman gave like a very well-constructed, sarcastic speech doing drugs. It was like super scripted, like unnaturally scripted. He had jokes for everything.
It was so sharp, I wrote it down word for word because I didn't want to forget the quips and the snark and get the proper da-da-da-da-da, you know, rhythm of it too. So here, let me reconstruct this for you. And I'll also do a bad combination of Boston and English accents. Here goes. I mean, that's his testimony. You're totally right. I didn't even think about that.
I will say one thing about the filmmaking is that this is how they introduce direct testimony. So what they'll do is they'll say, so, you know, Mr. Witness, tell me what happened. And then, you know, you'll see the flashback to what actually happened. And I really like that as cinematographically because, I mean, not just storytelling, I think it works well. And I don't know why more lawyer movies and shows don't use that. But also, it means that you're setting up with appropriate direct examination questions, right? Like, so instead of the typical, like, I've already torn out like half my remaining hair because the prosecutor will put a witness on the stand and on direct will begin with, now, isn't it true that, and I'm just like, oh, come on, guys. Like, literally, get a first-year law student to tell you can't ask leading questions on direct. So there are no leading questions on direct. Yeah. So I do like that.
One other moment in this scene that I loved was Bobby Seale sitting there, and like, again, he doesn't have a lawyer, but Fred Hampton leans forward to Bobby Seale and whispers in his ear. And the judge is like, who just whispered in your ear? And Bobby Seale's like, I'm not telling. And he's like, you have to tell me. What the fuck? Like, whispering based on movies is a huge deal in trials. How much whispering is actually allowed in real trial? Like, is that a strategy?
There's actually a fair amount of like whispering and talking and stuff that goes on, particularly in a big trial, because, you know, you'll have like three or four lawyers sitting at the table. It is not common to have a pro se defendant get advice from a high ranking official of the Black Panther sitting behind them in the gallery.
I love the idea, too, that Frank Langella's character, that out of touch judge from 1895, is like, let the record state that this is the famous Fred Hampton, leader of the Chicago branch of the Black Panther. You're like, come on. Yeah, okay, sure. Sure, you just knew that off the top of your head.
Do you ever do a fake whisper for like extra effect during court? No. I feel like if you pump fake some whispers, you could like build the moment and stuff, make it look like you learned something new.
Ooh, good idea.
I'll keep that in mind next time.
Do it. Do a really loud, like when the other side asks a question of your witness, be like, pretend
whisper,
like
they whisper. Exactly. Whisper, yeah.
He said, oh, shit. You know, and do like throw him off. Yeah.
Well, I'll take that under advisement. Okay. So after a couple days of trial, we then cut over to conspiracy headquarters. This is the like drug den that, you know, is going to be where the lawyers live for some reason during the trial.
I was having a hard time figuring out what they all seem to live there.
Yeah.
It's like a student lounge or something, you know, like I don't know.
Bernardine Dorn is the woman who is answering the phones. And I think, is she with the Yippies? You know, the lawyers just moved in there for
the Airbnb
for no good reason.
Sure. All right. We'll go with that. And this is where we get, female character number two. And she has just all kinds of like a couple lines. No real character.
We also learn about the jurors here. Right?
Yeah.
This is when
establish two jurors are on their side.
Right, exactly. So juror number six is cool because she has a James Baldwin novel, and juror number 11 was nodding when our team was talking. So those two are good for the defense. Mm-hmm. It seems like the bad guys would know that too, though, right?
Yeah. Look, like jurors never like nod up and down. During a trial, like you're admonished not to do that, right? When you serve on a jury.
So, Andrew, what do you make of this? Because this is a real thing that happened. The letters, at the very least, the movie wants to play it like the prosecution specifically identified, or somebody I'd specifically identified the juror 6 and 11 that were sympathetic to the defense, and then the prosecution like faked Black Panther letters to like compromise them and get them thrown off the jury.
Right.
Is that like a conspiracy theory? Is that, do you think history, what does history say about this? Did they really send, the Black Panthers really send the letters or what, you know, like?
It's difficult to figure out, but I lean very strongly in the direction of that this is an after the fact move by the FBI. And the reason is that one of the things, and again, we kind of set this up. This is a super interesting part of the story. Like, one of the things that the real judge did in this case was deny the defense the opportunity to ask a lot of questions about background during voir dire, during jury selection, right?
That would have been cool to see.
It would have been super interesting. And you could have just had the, like, again, reality, like that they tried to ask the kinds of questions that would enable you to strike jurors for cause about, you know, do you have a relative serving in Vietnam, right? Do you have a relative who is in college? What is your opinion of like college demonstrators, right? All of the kinds of things that, like, you know, we saw, for example, play out just recently in the Derek Chauvin trial, right? Like that was really well handled. I mean, you and I talked about this on the main show, like the judge in that case did a really, really good job of like letting the lawyers ask the kinds of questions that would enable you to disqualify jurors for cause. And there's even a line later in where Kunstler is like, well, we were out of peremptory challenges to keep, you know, so and so off the jury. Right. And it's like, this is a big important part and you've not portrayed it. So I was not happy.
Okay. Couple questions about that. Shouldn't the good jury, so the jury happened and juror 6 and juror 11 are cool with the defense. Shouldn't a good juror like that have like decoy books under, shouldn't they have like Ayn Rand under their arm or something as a decoy?
I always think that too.
Fake them out. and this is going to kind of overlap into then we get back and the movie makes it not clear, like, is it the FBI or did, you know, Judge Franklin Jella, like, you know, put all this up?
Well, yeah, the movie suggests that the prosecutor did, like, the evil non-Joseph Gordon-Levitt evil prosecutor did this, possibly.
Yeah. So the jurors are dismissed and we see them, like, you know, fist bump the defense counsel on the way out. It's like, don't do that. Like, that's not.
Couldn't the defense team write, like, low-level threatening notes to the conservative white jurors at that point? Yeah. Like silly stuff with, like, pranks. So it's not, like, big, scary, like, murder threat, but, like, enough to get them off the jury. Like, that's the one simple trick to fix any jury, right?
I mean, and get disbarred, but yes.
Yeah. But then we get the really, we get another what feels like a manufactured conflict, because then they find out, like, Franklin and Jella has sequestered the jury and they're super mad about it. I'm trying to figure out, Andrew, does that make sense? Would the defense be mad that they were sequestering the jury?
This scene made no sense to me whatsoever. I would expect, and again, maybe it's different at the time, right? Yeah. And again, this sort of goes into the whole, like, the press coverage of this was a super important act, part of the actual story, and it's edited out of the movie. Yeah. Like, maybe the press coverage, it was so favorable that, like, you would want them to be exposed to it. But, like,
I doubt it. I was going to say the other way.
Yeah.
No, I feel like Sorkin 2021'd this, or 2020'd this when he wrote it, you know, where he was like, oh, you'd sequester them so that they can't see these niche stand-up routines from Sacha Baron Cohen or something. But it's like, okay, if you're sequestering them, the bulk, it could just go the other way. Like, the bulk of the coverage on the two TV channels that exist in the country at this time are not going to be, like, Black Panther friendly channels. Like, there's no fucking way. Like, it's all going to be mainstream. The president of the United States is doing this and is against these people. You think that the mainstream media sphere that they're picking up is going to be, like, too friendly to you? You know, so in other words, there's no way that the sequestering of the jury would be some, like, blow to the defense. It just strikes me as another, like, way they're trying to manufacture being, you know, some drama about it. It's like, oh, okay, they're sequestered, whatever, that's fine.
Yeah. And again, 50-50, just insert, right? Like, it is not as though the movie is not trying to draw parallels to, you know, 2020, right? So insert the Chauvin trial, right? And be like, okay, had the jury been sequestered, who cares?
Like, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we have prosecutors and defense attorneys who listen to the show. So maybe there's an element of strategy here that I'm missing out on, but I don't think so.
It's possible, but I don't trust that Sorkin knows what he's talking about here. So sorry, I have no trust in him. Let's see. What do we got next?
We get Tom Hayden letting the air out of the cop tires. I could not tell if this actually happened.
Sorkin wants to make Tom Hayden out to be, like, the buttoned up, sensible, progressive, who's, you know, looks nicer and is not a yippie kind of thing, and therefore wasn't as, like, radical. But in reality, that's not really true. Like, yeah, he might have looked a little more clean cut, but he was just as fucking radical. And so I think
the movie plays Tom Hayden like us. Basically.
Yeah. No, that's what Sorkin very much tried to do. He tried to set it up as a proxy battle between, like, Sacha Baron Cohen is the, like, Chapo Trap House, and Eddie Redmayne is the, I'm not even joking. Like, that's what
the opening argument.
That's he very much tried to set it up that way.
Oh, but he wanted it to be like MLK and Malcolm X very much.
Yeah.
Sure.
The issue is, though, with things like this and some of the other scenes, that's not really true. And so you still have Eddie Redmayne's character doing all these radical things, but then, like, trying to justify it in a weird way. So this is one of those things where, like, yeah, he did do that and he did lead the riot at the thing. And it's because the character is not really how Sorkin's making it out to be. So that's why it seems a little off.
As long as we're extended universing this. So let's see, we could, Noah could be David Dellinger, right?
Oh, no way. What are you talking about? David Dellinger is the pacifist.
Well, he is the pacifist. Yeah.
Noah's Abby maybe more, I think, but politically not as much. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I was thinking, like, you know, oldest and most conservative, you know, on the scale here, but he'll never listen to this. So it's fine.
We get Bobby Seale trying to pass a motion in court here for a second, which was great. So again, Fred Hampton leans forward and, like, hands Bobby Seale a piece of paper.
Come on.
And the judge is like, Mr. Seale, are you cheating? He reads the legal statement that Fred Hampton gave him with like a legal precedent built in.
Did you get that legal statement
from a cheat sheet? You have to think it up yourself. That's a rule. You can't just get advice. Cheat sheets don't count.
The idea that Fred Hampton was just in this trial, like, it's so fucking contrived. I can't stand it. I'm sorry. I can't stand it. Fred Hampton is like in vogue in this year, and there's another movie about him. Sorkin's like, let's put him in the trial and have him handing notes to Bobby Seale. It's like, fuck off.
My note here is, in the next scene, the judge will have a plan to make the Cleveland Indians finish dead last. But I really did feel like this was the point at which, like, Frank Langella went from his spin on the actual trial court judge to just cartoon supervillainy, right? It was hard because then there wasn't any internal consistency, and it was just...
Yeah. You can just pass pieces of paper around in court. Like, nobody can, like, stop that, right? Moving paper.
Yeah.
Because they do that later.
They have Frank Langella do the obvious setup for the... It's the Sorkin equivalent of, like, the guy gets down on his hands and knees behind you, and then you, like, set yourself up in front of him so that the other character can, like, triumphantly push you over. Because he goes, you know, he's yelling. Like, Langella's yelling, shut up, Bobby Seale, like, stop, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then... You know, he's like, why can't I talk? And he's like, you have lawyers to speak for you. And Mark Rylance is like, no, he doesn't. And you're like, why would Frank Langella have said that? He specifically has made sure that he doesn't have a lawyer.
Dude,
like,
you keep teeing these up for the good guys. Yeah. You're killing me.
And the caption says it's trial day 23. Like, I'm pretty sure he knows by now.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So dumb.
Then I have to say, I kind of like this scene. This is the montage of how basically everybody in the SDS was an undercover FBI agent.
Yeah. This was hilarious.
And I thought... that's pretty much true, right? Like,
the girl, so the girl's a fictional character,
right? Yeah.
Yeah, the girl's fictional. And I read that it was like one undercover cop tried to be their bodyguard, and then another tried to, there was like two.
Okay.
But the movie makes it out like there's a million.
The movie goes nuts with it because the movie's just like, hey, Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, this is a random new white guy with a mustache. He wants to help with the secret plan. He's not a cop. I asked him. He had to tell me. He's not. He said he's not.
Yeah, they set it up that everyone in their lives, they're like, I need a plumber to fix my toilet. Hey! And it's like an undercover cop plumber comes over and like
just every single person out of the floor.
Yeah. I'm going to buy a coffee, the cop person making the coffee at the thing.
And two-thirds of them, like the fictional, you know, pretty young girl that they have get attached to Jerry Rubin, notwithstanding, like the other two look like they just came out of the DeBears sketch from Saturday Night Live.
They,
like,
really
they are mid-40s.
Absolutely,
like,
true.
I'm definitely not a Chicago cop.
Yeah.
it's got a Polish sausage flying outside of his mouth as he's talking. But then Jerry Rubin's in the bar and he's like, oh hello. Random new beautiful woman who just bought me a drink. Yeah. You want to hear my secret anarchy plot? This is 100% their fault, the characters in the movie. These are such obvious cops.
Well, it'll help you then to know that that's made up and it didn't happen. So,
okay. Yeah.
But
she is not real.
What I think of, though, that is real is the amount of resources the FBI spent infiltrating left-wing organizations in the 60s and 70s, right? Like, that was,
absolutely.
Like, Hoover was paranoid as shit. And, like, it was just...
Oh, yeah. It was like COINTELPRO and all that stuff, right?
And so the line of, like, was it just the seven of us, like, talking to 10,000 undercover cops in Chicago? Oh, that was really good. So, good scene.
Yeah, I liked it. So now we get one of the big scenes, which, you know, has some good elements and some of the dumbest fucking thing in the world elements, which is Abbie Hoffman and, you know, Jerry Rubin marching a bunch of people over to bail out Eddie Redmayne because he got arrested for letting the air out.
And we do get that, what do we want, fries, dog? When do we want it, fries, dog? Kind of a chance here that you're talking about.
What is that reference? I don't know.
That's from Jurassic Park. It's from literally one of the very best episodes of Futurama.
Oh, fries, dog. Oh, I couldn't understand what you were saying because it was so out of context. I was like, fries, dog. What's a fries, dog? Yeah. I thought it was like an up dog. You know? I was like, what do we want? Up dog. Gotcha.
What? Updog.
Well, that is one of the best episodes of all time. I'm with you there. Sorry, yeah. I didn't get the reverence. Yeah, so that's when they're doing the Whose Street's Our Street for, and again, I would just be like, shut up! I can't! I'm on your side, but I can't hear that 400,000 times in a row.
Nazis are going to use this later. I think we could just move on to something else.
So, yeah, this is an interesting scene. They're building it up. We get, it's essentially like when all the shit goes down. The movie portrays it like, okay, the cops have formed a barricade at the police station where Eddie Redmayne is. Fine. But then the movie says like the cops led them back the other way, kind of forced them back the other way, and then had like a whole fucking garrison of cops in the park. And I guess that part's not true. It made it, and one article was saying like this made it seem like the protesters charged the cops on that hill, which is actually not what happened and kind of plays into the right wing version of it where it's like the protesters. So, you know, whatever. It's kind of a historical thing in a way that some people have a problem with how that makes the protesters look. Not a huge deal. But anyway, that's what happens. They force them to that hill. The thing that just drives me nuts, because all this, you know, there's some real footage interspersed in this and it's a decent scene. It's a big climax. But the thing that gets me is they decide, I think Sorkin decided, I need Jerry Rubin to be more saintly. Like, he's not good enough. I need him to just be so fucking... So, there's a girl with an American flag that some frat boys, I guess 1968 frat boys, have been, like, yelling, like, oh, the flag! Ugh. Apparently, the real-life version of this is somebody replaced an American flag with a communist flag, and that's why some people were yelling about it. So, Sorkin takes that, and he replaces that with, a girl holding an American flag that some frat boys are just yelling at for some reason. And then, in the middle, we get interspersed with Abbie Hoffman's stand-up, where he's like, tear gas is a fucking blowtorch, right, bro? Like, fucking... But with a little bit of English accent in it.
He also says riot clubs are made of the same wood as baseball bats.
I know.
I was like, the type of wood seems irrelevant. What?
Oh, I thought they were made out of, like, cork. Like, they're just floppy.
They got balsa, and it's just breaking all over the place.
I know. I thought that was so hacky. And like, I wasn't sure if, like, maybe he really... if he really said that to try to make a point, but yeah, that was a kind of a silly thing. The same wood as baseball bats. Wood. You had me at wood. If you're beating me with a wood thing, I'm not. Oh, is that elm or is that
maple?
Oak?
Maple.
Yeah. as my head's getting bashed in. Yeah. And so he talks about the fact that like tear gas, it's a blowtorch. You know, he's doing all this stuff, and then in the middle of the riot, Sorkin decides that the frat boys have taken the flag from this woman and are going to initiate a public rape of a woman because they're frat boys in the middle of a tear gassed riot where cops are beating people. They're like, oh, this is a good time for a sexual assault. We'll just do this real quick. It's so needless. It's stupid. There's no way they're going to, in the middle of a tear gas riot, there's going to be like a frat boy sexual assault, like a group sexual assault of a girl. It's the weirdest thing. Why stop there? Have Jerry Rubin save a baby from drowning, and then like a guy's going to jump off a bridge. You're like, no, don't do it, bro. And like saves him.
Yeah. He goes through then like a goes whole- back in time with his time machine that he invented and kills Hitler and comes back to the president. Yeah. And the right. Like, we get it. He was getting beat up by cops.
Yeah.
He's a good guy. We already knew that.
Exactly. He's got like a Groundhog Day of saintliness before getting arrested. He's saving a kid falling off a tree.
Adolf Hitler? He punches him in the face.
Because Thomas says, as you pointed out, like in the 80s, Rubin became a stockbroker, right? Like, it's a weird...
A successful stockbroker, like a rich-ass stockbroker.
Yeah, like a super, yeah.
And then died by getting hit by a car while jaywalking.
Yeah.
What a weird way to go. Don't jaywalk, I guess, is the lesson.
So, and now, as punishment for my saying that I had liked the previous scene, we get this inexplicable, like, the movie's over 2 hours, right? Like, this is not like a taut, like, 96 minute, like, every scene in here is gold. This is Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin confronting Joseph Gordon-Levitt on the street with his kids for reasons? Like,
no reason.
Can Absolutely someone explain no this to me? Like, and, no. And also, by the way, like, it under, like, sorry, I'm so angry. Like, like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt is being played as ace prosecutor, right? Like, you know, he's the Captain Kirk of prosecutors that they got to break out to, like, try this case because nobody else can win it. And, like, you don't talk to criminal defendants on the street that you're prosecuting.
He even says it's so silly. Jerry and Abby are sitting on a bench, and just for no reason, they're like, oh, hello, antagonist main character
yeah,
who might or might not
movie.
Have a heart of gold. Fancy meeting you here, Chicago.
Famously tiny town.
Right. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt immediately gives a dollar to his two little daughters to go tip some musicians and buy some candy for themselves. And then he's like, guys, you shouldn't talk to me without your lawyer. Yeah, whatever. You should take the plea.
It's stupid. Completely manufactured. And the main function of this is to do more Jerry Rubin dumb stoner comedy where he's like, this makes Jerry Rubin so dumb, like on a catastrophic level. I get you're playing him for laughs, but he's now asking Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who is the prosecutor, about the FBI undercover agent that like infiltrated his group and like he fell in love with because he was with her for 5 seconds. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, as if Sorkin kind of recognizes how dumb this is like, hey, I don't work for the FBI. I'm part of, I'm just the prosecutor. And but he's like, no matter. I'll just keep going with my really stupid rant about how you shouldn't have broken my heart. And it's like, all that is fake. You know, it'd be one thing if it was like, well, there's some real basis for this. So that's why, but it's all nothing. That's all made up.
And Jerry Rubin's so mad. He's like,
yeah.
Well, isn't that like illegal entrapment or something? And Joseph Gordon-Levitt's like, did you have sex with her? Did she have sex with you? And
yeah.
He's like, she made really good puns. She made a joke. She said one egg is an, come on. She was very charming. Okay. And just one other point, the way they end this scene, it's so silly. It's so peak Sorkin. He's like, they're talking to each other and Joseph Gordon-Levitt is like, so Abby Hoffman, I guess you got what you wanted. You got your attention out of this whole trial. And Abby Hoffman's like, yeah, I guess Nixon got what he wanted, too. And Joseph Gordon's like, how about that? This was a fun conversation about us both understanding the big picture in a very pithy way. Okay, bye! End of scene.
Yeah, it's bad. It's a bad scene, and it should feel bad.
Well, now we get crazy history because one of the chief spectators of this trial has now been killed by the FBI, which is watch Judas and the Black Messiah if you would like to see this portrayed in a better way that actually happened.
I did like that they interspersed where they could, you know, the black and white footage of real events. So yeah, so this is call comes into, you know, hippie commune HQ in the middle of the night, and we learn that Fred Hampton was killed, and then I just don't understand why they've decided to play it this way.
Yeah,
and like, that's what leads to what really happened in this case, which was that in the trial, Bobby Seale repeatedly objected to not having his lawyer present, tried to cross-examine witnesses, all perfectly reasonable
things. As he should have done, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, they have him bound and gagged. I mean, they have Judge Frank Langella, like, say to the bailiff, like, you know, take this guy into the back room
all
and give
true.
Him, you know, what did he say? Yep. Give him what's coming to him? Wow.
Yeah, he actually got gagged.
Deal with him as he should be dealt with, I think, was the... Yeah, that's all from... Okay, I should have said this early on. The trial transcript is available. So Sorkin could have just used a lot of that and kept it real, which, you know, you got to think there's a lot of, and another thing that's interesting while we're on that topic is another of the historicity kind of articles I read was like, yeah, the defense was actually super gimmicky, and Sorkin doesn't cover that at all. Like, the defense put on all these celebrity witnesses, and it wasn't really the kind of thing, but whatever. They've decided to make this be like kind of the crescendo of the Bobby Seale story, which, you know, is okay. But in reality, all the Bobby Seale stuff happened before Fred Hampton was killed, I believe, because Bobby Seale just got tired, as you said, he got tired of not having representation, kept trying to like cross examine witnesses. And that all happened, I think, like a month or two before this Fred Hampton thing.
And they just make it into this silly moment here, too. He has like an objection and he tries to represent himself a little bit. And the judge is like, okay, that was your one outburst for today. Next time you get a timeout.
You get one.
And then he outbursts again. The judge is like, last warning, I'm going to count to 3, 2.5, and go fuck yourself. All right. Yeah. And then he gets gagged. This silly moment, but it's horrible in real life. Yeah.
And there's an extra silliness on top of it because then we have Judge Frank Langella monologuing, and he begins with, and this is the kind of thing that like non-lawyers would write if they've watched and or written a lot of law drama stuff. So the judge does not have to say, let the record show that. Like, you're the fucking judge, right? the transcriptionist is accurately recording what right. you are saying. And you only say, let the record reflect, when you are preserving something for an appeal. Judge Frank Langella is not preserving anything for his appeal,
that's
right?
Funny. Like,
oh, God.
It's like if you had a camera on you and you're doing something and you're like, let the camera show that I am jumping up and down. You're like, it is. It's doing that.
You don't have to say that before each sentence you say into the camera.
It just does. Yeah. The camera does it. It does the work.
And then this was my low point. I was legitimately angry because they bring back Bobby Seale and then they have, you know, our saintly prosecutor. So Richard Schultz stand up and move for a mistrial. What really happened was, again, the interplay between this case and public coverage, a group of highly respected criminal defense attorneys filed a lawsuit seeking an injunction to get an order to force Judge Hoffman to sever out Bobby Seale from the rest of the trial of the Chicago 8. And like, it's an obvious mistrial when the judge orders the defendant bound and gagged in the courtroom. This was not like, you know, prosecutor with a heart of gold relents. This
was he's like, I'm going to toss you guys a bone and I will move for a mistrial on Bobby Seale. It's like, what? And then his other prosecutors arguing with him, you know, his teammate. And it's just like, to what end? Like, what does that do? To have Joseph Gordon-Levitt be like the heart of gold, except he's still a complete asshole for doing any of this. But also the whole time he's a little conflicted about it. I don't know what it adds. Weird.
Yeah.
Adds nothing. There was one other important part of the scene, though, which is the note passing, which apparently is part of court. The defense, they pass it. They're like, psst, guys, check out this note. It says, don't stand for the judge. Pass it on. So when Frank Langella comes back in for the next thing, they're going to stay seated. And first of all, you're allowed to pass. Like, does that count as like one of your whispers? Are you allowed to like just pass notes?
You get a combined quota of three whispers / notes.
It's like peremptory challenges.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. That's exactly right.
So that happens. The judge leaves for something, then he comes back in after a recess. And Tom Hayden he forgets.
Yeah.
So he stands up and everybody else stays seated. And then he has this great embarrassing moment just being like, sorry.
Stretching.
I was tucking in my shirt. Yeah. Let the record show. I sat back down now. Please read that back to me. I'm sitting now. I'm sitting. I said I'm sitting now. Steno. So stupid.
Did you, Andrew, do you know, is this based on anything? Is that real?
I could not find if that was real.
I wasn't able to verify either, and we get a really stupid callback to this later that I wasn't, you know. Is that the kind of thing, like, would the transcriptionist or whatever you call them in the trial, would they have noted, like, if somebody stood up or didn't stand up when you're going with that level of detail?
I mean, probably not. Like, it would be a sort of 50-50 if you're the judge. Let's take a step back, right? It is clear that the defendants displayed, an utter lack of respect for the proceedings over the entirety of this 5-month trial, right? Like that clearly happened as they should have, right? And so a lot of the like fun gags that they do, Abbie Hoffman and Jerry, showing up in robes,
so good
in judge's robe, like that really happened. I do not believe they had police uniforms on under the robes, which I like. That's
funny.
Fine.
That's funny. Yeah. No, nothing wrong with that.
That's really, that's an example of like, well done, Aaron Sorkin, right? Like that take that kind of liberty. But again, because of the numerous contempt citations that actually happened at the end of the trial, it strikes me as plausible that this could have happened. And it would be sort of 50-50 to me that like, if you're halfway through the trial and the judge is like, I've been dealing with your fucking shenanigans from the judge's perspective, right? It would be sort of 50-50 where the judge would sort of stop and say, you know, and sort of clear his throat, you know, say, did you not hear the bailiff say all rise or what, you know what I mean? Like, and that would then show up in the transcripts. But if the judge was just sort of like, Oh, I see.
Well, and it was as the judge was leaving after the whole gagging thing. It was after they you know, were like, oh, we're going to adjourn after that. So, like, I could see the judge being like, all right, fuck it. I'm already on my way out of here. Like,
right. Yeah, it is. I mean,
he stops and walks back. I said, I'm leaving. All rise. Looks back. I can't leave until you.
I'm stuck here. The law says.
I didn't think about it. Yeah, they could outfox me this way by just see who stays seated longer.
There is a line here that I absolutely believe is real. Like, I don't know if it's from the transcript or what, but this is good Sorkin writing, because when fucking stupid ass, dumb, stupid, okay, it's bad Sorkin writing and good. So when Joseph Gordon-Levitt, for no fucking reason, is like, I'm going to move because I'm in a principle that I will move for a mistrial. And then Mark Rylance is like, yeah, no, this is fucking absurd. And Frank Langella is like, I have lived a very long time and you're the first person to ever suggest that I was discriminatory against a black man or whatever. And then other defense attorney we haven't talked about, defense attorney Sam Harris, is like, well, then I'm the second. And then it's like, I actually believe I believe that Frank Langella's character would have said that about himself. Like, no one has ever accused that I was racist. I actually do like that bit of writing. I thought it was funny.
That judge listed his black friends in that moment in history, for sure.
Definitely. He has a quote later on, this fucking asshole. This judge was terrible. He has a quote later on where he's like, I did nothing during that trial that I regret. I acted with dignity and whatever. Like, he said that like 10 years later or more.
I believe the first sentence.
God, what an asshole. Colossal asshole.
And we should add parenthetically, so the second lawyer is Leonard Weinglass, who is portrayed as the Art Garfunkel of the team, you know, throughout this entire trial. And that's okay. Like, I mean, in reality, like, he was, you know, one of the nation's most preeminent First Amendment lawyers at the time, and had a huge active role in the trial. But later on, right, he was the lawyer in the Pentagon Papers case, right?
Interesting. I think as an actor, when you see that, like, oh, yeah, I'm on the two-person defense team. Who's the other? Who am I acting with? Mark Rylance? Oh, fuck. I'm not getting any lines, am I? You've cast Mark Rylance as the other guy, like Academy Award-winning, amazing actor. I feel like you're going to be an afterthought if Mark Rylance is your partner there.
He's got the brown suit for being the good guy, schlubby lawyer. Yeah. I'm wearing a gray suit like a professional.
I need to clarify, when I say he's defense attorney Sam Harris, it's because he looks exactly like Sam Harris. It's not because during the trial he was like, hey, did you know that IQ correlates with race. I want to make very clear, it's not about anything he said. It's about the fact that he literally is Sam Harris and looks. It's weird. It looks exactly like him. If they ever make a movie about Sam Harris, which they shouldn't, this guy, hopefully he'll still be around. Next scene, which is the big breakthrough, you know, like strategy for the lawyers.
This is the silliest thing. Okay. So they finally realize the key here, and the way it happens,
we're back
is
at
so
the student
dumb.
Lounge or whatever the
right,
hell.
They're back at the Airbnb student lounge frat house defense,
where we have
HQ.
To throw in that the girl, the secretary, is getting calls from angry white people, and she's responding by saying, yeah, it is better when I have fuck black dudes. Like, that's definitely, you know, like, that's her care. Cool. Great female character.
Oh, my God.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Right. This
was meant to be like a feminism moment.
Yeah.
But they fucked it up so bad because she's failing the Bechdel test so hard. She's literally talking about a penis. That's her entire role here. Literally talking about a penis is the entire thing for this female character. So dumb.
It's like, what
but
is the opposite of passing
like,
the
like
Bechdel
penis.
Test? Yeah.
Right. It like couldn't fail it worse.
Like, you actually got a negative score on the. I didn't even know that. I thought it was just a zero. But no, you dipped into the negative on the Bechdel test.
But you got 400 points for your name. Oh, she's not named. So you go.
There you go.
Right. But the point of the scene is to figure out the big strategy for the finale. And that strategy is Ramsey Clark, who was the AG before the current AG. He's Lyndon Johnson's AG. And the idea is that they have to just, like, remember that. And and the way it happens is, like, hold on, minor character, did you say Ramsey Clark? And, like, the two lawyers look at each other, and they lock eyes knowingly for a while. Yeah. Somebody else tries to talk, and they're like, shut the fuck up, we're figuring out the finale.
Yeah, we're having an aha moment here. Quiet, everybody.
They might as well be playing Scrabble. Somebody flips the board and Ramsey Clark gets spelled out somehow by the letters. It's so dumb.
As they storm out in their big light bulb aha moment of, oh yeah, we just remembered that Ramsey Clark was the previous AG, and maybe this is some... The theory of the movie, which is not correct, by the way, like, I've tried to research into this, and none of this is anything, is that, like, part of it was a fuck you to Ramsey Clark by the new AG. Like, that's part of this whole trial, and that's just not true. But anyway, to set that aside, as they leave, they have fucking Sacha Baron Cohen say, and William Kuntzler just showed up as he leaves. Yeah. You're like, what... Yeah. Okay, like, come on. Just, it's so hacky. Like, it's,
Yeah. I believe we have a finale. Yeah, okay, okay.
But then we get to see the scene of them going over to recruit Ramsey Clark, who is played by Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton has been both Batman and the Vulture in Spider-Man. So, like, he
and
knows
Birdman.
Both. Yeah.
Yeah,
I love Michael
Keaton. I love him. He's a fantastic actor. He knows how to play both a comic book hero and a comic book villain.
Yeah.
And that is on display with his character of Ramsey Clark.
He's both in this scene. It's great.
He needs to be eating an apple in this scene.
This is the most bizarre. I don't know what Sorkin was trying to do. But before we get into that scene, we have the 900-year-old black housekeeper wearing an old-timey housekeeper outfit that has to say, this is so far-fetched. Like, I don't know how else to say it. So she's apparently a housekeeper for the previous attorney general dressed in an old-timey 1800s maid's outfit. And as Eddie Redmayne comes in, she's like, hey, you're socialist activist Tom Hayden. I read in the news that when the Bobby Seale thing happened, that everybody didn't stand for the judge, except you stood for the judge. Why'd you? And you're like, come on, really? Like, am I to believe that this really fucking happened? Is there any chance that that would make any sense? Like, she would have been combing the minutia of the transcript that whatever.
I forgot about the secret note. It was a secret. Okay. The record shows that I sat back down right away because I forgot. That's fine. Why was Tom Hayden even in this scene?
Nope, doesn't make sense.
He shouldn't be in the scene.
Does not make sense.
No.
Only brought him to maybe give a pithy speech at some point.
Well, it's like, also that Sorkin can give another unnamed female character two or three lines that apply to the male character, basically.
Right. And also, like, having Ramsey Clark live in a plantation with an African American woman as a maidservant, like, really undercuts.
Weird.
Like Ramsey Clark was a legitimate progressive activist.
Oh, wow.
Right?
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. No, like, when he left the Johnson administration, like, he taught at Howard University, a historically black university. He taught at their law school for a while and then got involved in Democratic politics from the far left. Cool.
So, legitimately good guy. But this scene is baffling to me.
Bonkers.
So, like, weird.
Keaton has a bowl of snack mix on his desk that is just for him in the scene, and it's my fucking favorite. He never stops fiddling with it, taking little bites. Such a good power move.
At one point, he tells the guys to arrest him, which is like, do they arrest people? Is that a
no.
thing? That they don't arrest people?
Okay,
I think the attorney general would know that, but that's fine.
Yeah, he's got two, like, other Fed guys there.
Yeah, it's just an Aaron Sorkin fake out. Like, they're supposed the defense is thinking, oh no, this means he's going to tell us to fuck off, and he's got the big bad attorney general people there. And then Michael Keaton's like, I brought them here so I could say fuck on, like, the opposite of what the expectation that you arbitrarily artificially assigned to the scene.
That's hilarious. If Ramsey Clark did that on purpose in real life, if he called two Feds and was like, yeah, no, fly out here from wherever you are, and I want to do this really important thing. And then it was just to do a dramatic switcheroo right in their face and be like, prank, you flew here, suck it.
But then the weird thing is that he still has, Sorkin remembers he has Eddie Redmayne in the scene for no reason, like, absolutely no reason. And then he has Eddie Redmayne say a few lines as though he didn't already decide to come testify. It's weird. Like, were you just confused during the scene? I was just confused. I didn't understand who was saying what. Like, he tried to make the big moment of, I'm your star witness. But then Eddie Redmayne was like, not, he was talking as though he hadn't said that still. He's like, you got to find the courage. And they're like, what? What are you talking about? He already said, yeah. Weird.
I don't get it. Yeah. What's the legal situation here, Andrew? So they seem to be claiming that the former AG wouldn't have to, like, ever answer any question about any court case because that's a law. And then Michael Keaton is like, actually, it's not. And that's the whole thing?
If I want to give Aaron Sorkin credit here, I think it is that he's making an analogy to the Trump administration and to, like, Don McGahn. So feds from the AG's office are there to back up Clark's claim of executive privilege to not testify, to ignore the subpoena. And then they get in there and Clark's like, ha! Fuck on. I love that. I'm going to start using that.
Fuck on. You thought I was going to say fuck off, but.
Right.
Fuck on.
And by the way, there was no indication in the record that there was ever a debate about whether, you know, Ramsey Clark was going to. No, because
this whole thing is imaginary. Yeah. This whole thing's imaginary.
But what did happen is what that then transitions to, which is the defense goes to call Ramsey Clark and Judge Hoffman did indeed order that he be questioned outside the jury. And again, this is another one of these where, like, what really happened is so much more dramatic. What we get is we get stupid, yelly arguments from Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Again, completely contradicting his character, right? Like,
he knows, had a heart of gold. I don't get it.
He knows these arguments are bullshit, right?
So dumb.
And we get these yelly arguments back and forth between Joseph Gordon-Levitt and defense counsel. What really happened was they proceeded question by question. The prosecution objected after every single question. And roughly half the time, and on all of the important stuff, the judge sustained the objections such that virtually none of the testimony was able to go to the jury.
Here's what I want to get kind of your legal take on, Andrew, because the whole setup here, the whole thrust of this, which again doesn't end up mattering at all, but they try to make this big dramatic light bulb moment, was the guy who's not Hank from Breaking Bad in the beginning was so mad that he didn't send in his resignation letter until an hour before his confirmation, which doesn't fucking matter. Like, that, does that matter? That doesn't,
no,
there's no, no evidence. I've tried to look that up. People are like, this doesn't, there's no coverage that says this happened. I also don't know why that would have even been a big fuck you, like, if he did do it. And so they try to make it out like this whole thing is as a result of that. But in reality, Michael Keaton came in to testify about just the police presence, like how Johnson had set up a giant police presence at the time, ahead of time, to sort of build that case. Like, this was something that maybe was more the cops' responsibility than the protesters. And that's what the actual testimony was about. But the movie wants to say, no, no, if I have Michael Keaton come in here and say, I decided not to prosecute these people, but then the new AG did, that would be like a devastating blow to the case. Is that something that would even matter, really?
That wouldn't. But what I think they're trying to get at is that there was a determination made by the prior AG's office, by Michael Keaton's office, that the cops started the riot.
Is that real?
No, that is not.
I was going to say, like, I would find it. We don't even do that now. Like, in 2021, in 2020, when we saw on TV the police starting the riots, America was like, damn, those protesters, they keep rioting. You're like, what?
But it was such, like, an obvious contrived moment in the case that we see. They're questioning Ramsey Clark, and they're like, so, is there anything else that, like, completely clears the defendants that you could tell us about? And he's like, they were, like, Marissa Tomei, like, they were, we did a whole separate investigation about all the charges. They were stupid. Facts and evidence. Done. But that gets canceled by the judge because the jury's not hearing this.
Yeah. And so in reality, like, defense counsel does kind of give up in this case, but it's not just when, you know, most of the objections to Clark's testimony were sustained, right? It was really a culmination of the entirety of the 5 months. And, the way the movie handles that is there's a recurring laugh line of whenever there's an objection, Hoffman, Rubin, and members of the audience will chant either sustained or overruled, depending on which side it comes from. So I thought that was a pretty funny device.
I enjoyed – so this was another peak Sorkin moment. They ask, hey, did President Johnson say anything to you important last year as AG? And there's an objection here. And the objection is attorney-client privilege. We can't
talk
about
this. This was all set up for that.
And Keaton is like, ha, 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 you stupid horse. Yeah. Actually, the president isn't a client of the attorney general. I'm the only one in this entire room who knew that.
Who knows that? Yeah. Yep. And again, that's why I led with this. This seemed pretty clearly to be directed at Trump. And, I was willing
this
to
is
forgive
supposed to
that.
Target that. Yeah.
But I will tell you, like, there was an independent commission on the riots in Chicago that had classified it as a police riot by the middle of the trial, right? The report was publicly released December 1st, 1968, characterized the convention violence as a, quote, police riot and recommended.
Is that something you could have brought into the trial?
Yeah, absolutely. You could have brought it.
You wouldn't really need Ramsey Clark to be your pretend star witness that didn't do anything. Okay.
Right.
It's okay.
The line I do love is, as Michael Keaton leaves, he's like, just get to work on your appeal to Mark Rylance, which I love because it's like him saying, like, this judge is fucked. Like, you're not winning this one.
Right. I like that moment
a lot.
Yeah,
I like that. It was a good line. Now we start. This is where it really fucking starts sucking, in my opinion. We get. I have next the specifically the pacifist character doing the thing that he does. Are we there? Is that where we are?
Yeah, we can do that.
Oh, yeah. Dellinger.
So Dellinger, specifically a pacifist, lifelong, sat out of not only Vietnam, but World War II, which is a funny line that Mark Rylance had earlier. He's like, yeah, you were a conscientious objector to World War II. I want to punch you, like, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny.
And the other lawyer who was Jewish was like, yeah, are we punching him in the dick? You really? You're going to brag about conscientious objector? It was World War II, man.
Yeah. They have his character in this courtroom scene where he starts to get a little mad at something. They have this, another one of these fucking Sorkin crescendos where he's like, you don't need to touch me. You don't need to touch my arm for the security guard. And then he turns around and punches out the other bailiff or whatever. He punches him out. Pacifist.
Lefty punches him.
Totally too. Just knocks him down.
I got excited.
And he's like, oh, I lost it. And you're like, he's specifically not a that. You've taken a guy who's a not of that, and you've decided, because it'll be dramatic, to have him punch out the bailiff that's like, come on, man. It's so fucking dumb. Why would you do that? It didn't happen.
I got all
didn't
excited. It worked on me. I got all pumped up here. That got me going.
And so it's set. The backdrop is, which, by the way, correct backdrop, if you are defense counsel, like, which of your clients are you putting on the stand?
Yeah.
Right?
Are we getting to this?
Yeah, well, that's,
That's the next scene, which I have 400 pages on. Apologies.
But
this is the only thing I care about in this entire movie.
All right, well, take over. I don't want to interfere with your notes.
So that little moment happened for no fucking reason. It was stupid. And then we have the big scene. This is the dramatic. There's going to be a multi-phase debate happening here. This is Sorkin really just fucking. Oh, he just fucking Sorkin jizzes all over the script here. We get the Abby, as I've already covered. Abby is like the stand-in for Chapo, and Hayden is like the, I guess, Elizabeth Warren kind of, maybe, like, and they have an argument where it's one of those, like, hey, why do you hate me so much moments in a script.
You have 5 minutes uninterrupted and go. Why do you hate me? Exactly. It better be pithy.
And Eddie Redmayne is like, you know why? Because 50 years from now, people will just, when they think of progressive politics, they're not going to think about social justice and all blah, blah, blah. They're just going to think about you. And that's going to cause us to lose elections.
Okay. In fairness, is that not true? That, like, the yippies did make the progressive team, look kind of like idiots sometimes.
Yes.
They did not help win elect. Like, just look back at American politics after 1968. You get Nixon, Reagan, Bush era, giant tax cuts for rich people, the birth of trickle-down economics. It sucked.
That's fair, but Eddie Redmayne is a socialist in 1968. Do you think he's, like, super concerned with winning elections? Do you think he's the elections guy? Yeah, we're about to win all the socialist elections. We're going to have socialists in every single successful fucking chamber of government if it weren't for Sacha Baron Cohen. We would have had a full...
So and that's exaggerated, guy, but Eddie Redmayne's character does, he's the only one in the Breakfast Club clothes.
Yeah,
he goes on to be the he gets elected to Congress and spends like decades there. He's the only one who does anything real.
State legislature. So, you know, let's be clear.
Yeah, he gets elected in California.
But also, like, Hayden is the guy, remember, it's their movie, but they put the line, like, there's no difference between Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon into his mouth.
Yes, exactly.
So, it's definitely contradictory.
This is, it's like, weird. Item 400 in my list of 400 things that sucks about this scene. I haven't gotten there. So, but listen to the non-sec, this, if this is Pert Apley, it's in the cadence of an argument, listen to this conversation between those two people. We're zooming in on this scene because it's so fucking annoying. He says, that's what he said. So that was his complaint, which fine. We've already discussed, like, I think it's dumb to put it in that character's mouth, but whatever. Like, I'll grant it. Okay. That's an argument that someone else might have said about Sacha Baron Cohen. Fine. But what he said was, we're going to lose elections. And then Abby says, winning elections, that's the first thing on your wish list, huh? He says to the socialist in 1968, which is not even a logical extension of what he said. He didn't say it was the first thing on his wish list. And then he says, equality, justice, education, poverty, and progress, they're second. And this is all the setup because it's the, you know, it's the stand in for like maybe the far leftist versus, you know, kind of Elizabeth Warren Lane or, you know, in the 2020 primary. He gets this huge setup for the, if you don't win elections, then it doesn't matter what comes second. And it's astonishing that someone has to still explain that to you. He does the bang on the wall thing. And then we do, this is another Sorkin trope that just kills me. We do the fake out win of the argument. He loves to do this. It's like he likes to set up the argument underdog. It's like a Rocky, you know, like movie where he's like, well, that settles that. Eddie Redmayne just won the argument, everybody. Nothing to see here. It's all over. And the other character comes in. He's like, oh,
is it?
Yeah. The other character comes in with a totally useless line about some shit that has nothing to do with, oh, so guys, are we gonna get pizza tonight? Are we gonna? And then Sacha Baron Cohen has to give the little quiet, we don't have any money. Sorry, what? What? And we have to do that. Like, you can't hear him right at first. Like, that's key to setting up the underdog winner argument is Eddie Redmayne can't hear him. What? He says, we don't have any money. So I stage stunts and the cameras come and the microphones come and wait for it. Here we go. We're setting this up. You could never guess what he's going to say. You know what he's going to say? It's astonishing that someone still has to explain that to you. Whoa!
You used his line. My words on me.
Oh,
so well.
Shit.
I said that just now, damn, and now it hurts my face because you said it in reverse.
Yeah, and you thought the argument was over, but then killer comeback with the same line. That doesn't make any sense because neither of them have any money. They're not, whatever. His response is, you're trading a cow for magic beans. And I think because Sorkin realized that's the dumbest fucking thing anyone's ever written, he has Ruben say, but that worked out, you know? And then that's kind of like a funny little thing. And you're like,
there was
okay,
a giant
I guess
up there. I think it worked, right?
There's a little, like, again, this is kind of like Tarantino-style dialogue here where, you know, they have the bad quip and then Jerry Rubin is like, right, but that worked out.
Yeah.
And then there's like 5 minutes of discussion about Jack and the Beanstalk. They're like, right, and the giant was up. Was he a bad guy? I don't remember.
Yeah, which fine. Okay, cool.
It was very Tarantino-esque to me.
And now this is the part that really loses it. Okay, you ready for this? Because then Abby goes on to say, Hey, Eddie Redmayne, don't you think if Kennedy were alive, this wouldn't have happened? You know, this would have gone differently. He's like, yeah, I think the Irish win the fucking Chicago something or other. And they're like, yeah, I agree. So Eddie Redmayne, aren't you glad when that bullet ripped through Kennedy's head? Because otherwise there'd be no Tom Hayden, there'd be no Chicago. Okay, this is not true on any level. Like, if you look at Tom Hayden's fucking Wikipedia, the Chicago part is like one line in his career that he's already well under, like he's already written, as we'll get to in a second, the Port Huron statement. That has no logical sense that's made to that. And Hayden replies, I was the pallbearer for Robert Kennedy, which is true. And then again, Sorkin realizes he's written the dumbest fucking thing and there's no way out of it. So here's the response to that. So like, aren't you glad? Aren't you secretly glad they died? And he says, I'm the pallbearer. And then somebody please tell me what this means. Sacha Baron Cohen says, that's right. That's right. We're not going to jail because of what we did. We're going to jail because of who we are. Think about that the next time you shrug off cultural revolution.
I cannot make heads or tails of that
fucking
statement
idea, but it was done in the cadence of a really big crescendo of brilliant argument.
In what way was the head of the SDS shrugging off cultural revolution?
Exactly. It makes no sense. None of that makes any fucking sense. And it's all done with the attitude of like a brilliant debate that just ends. And then I think finally Mark Rylance comes in and bails them out of this. God.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's just, it's Abbie Hoffman and Tom Hayden, like, realizing they each have a little bit of genius to offer. That's the whole point, right?
Yep.
Okay, here we go. So now we get the even worse part, which is the Perry Mason moment.
It gets ridiculous here.
The Perry Mason moment, but with Andrew, I know you can tell us that this is kind of real. You have said, like, okay, if I have a client that wants to testify and I'm like, all right, we're not going to put you on the stand. You do the practice, right?
Yeah.
With them. And that's a real part. But Tom Hayden is like, I should go on the stand because I'm Tom Hayden.
Because I'm the reasonable, right? I'm the centrist that they've been playing out of all
right,
this.
Right, but they just found out that there's a tape of Hayden literally starting the riot in question. And somehow it's on tape magically. Yeah. So he's like, all right, let's do a test run of the cross-examination. I have weirdly eloquent responses to everything that's like super good.
Well, but Sorkin's characters are simultaneously geniuses who deliver ultimate snark and so fucking dumb that you get Perry Masoned by your own attorney before you've already announced, you've already given up the game. The attorney is like, oh yeah, you think you can go on the stand? Well, let's try that out and see how you do. And Hayden's character is apparently so fucking stupid that he gets Perry Masoned by his own attorney. And he ends with a slap of like, you can't head. Yes, I ordered the code red. And they're like, oh shit. His own attorney got him to say that in practice. Like, what?
Yeah. Right.
Are you dumb?
They're doing the fake cross-examination, the practice cross. And we also get flashbacks to the actual thing that happened, which is the moment when Hayden got caught on tape starting a riot, which I guess actually did happen in history.
Yeah.
So Dellinger, the pacifist guy, he's talking in the flashback. He's talking to the big group in the park in Chicago, and he's like, hey, Tom, they're getting a little riled up. Tell everyone to stay calm.
Right.
It's so, what we see here, it's just so over the top, obvious, contrived again. Tom Hayden's like, no, Dellinger the pacifist. I advocate violence now. It's not like I'm on tape here. Let the blood flow in the streets. So, literal blood of police officers. I'm saying we should murder cops right now. Let's do this. Imminent violence. This is not protected free speech.
And so can we talk about how this is introduced, which is this is allegedly introduced after 4.5 months of trial via tape sent to Mark Rylance, right? As, oh, this is, we just now processed this evidence. But what it is Tom Hayden walking up to the microphone from the stage that they have constructed in the park. And this is sprung like top secret Perry Mason evidence. Everybody in that room was in the park at the time. Like,
they all
knew that they were there.
You would have had testimony from the police saying, I heard him say this thing already, even if they didn't have tape.
It is just fucking bonkers. And then on top of it, it's being introduced as, well, they will use this to impeach you if we put you on the stand. And it's like, no, they will use this as affirmative evidence that you started the fucking riot, whether we put you on the stand or not. Yeah. Like, that's what we call a statement against interest. Like, it is just, it's so bad.
And then we get the worst part of the movie. The worst part of the movie.
I think you said that like 8 times already.
I know. We've been building up to it. It gets this whole sequence gets worse and worse as it goes. Then we get, this is supposed to be some brilliant aha thing that Sorkin wants us to realize. We've set up Abbie. He tried to set up earlier that Abbie Hoffman is actually super genius and Tom Hayden thinks he's dumb because he's a comedian, but actually he's really smart, which fine. Okay. Cool to set that up. And then, so here's what happens here. Eddie Redmayne mumbles like our, what? Huh? And everybody in the room, because Sorkin wrote it, has to do what? What? Huh? I didn't hear you.
Somebody flip a Scrabble board. I feel like we're going to focus on some grammar thing now.
Yeah. He goes, our. He does it a couple times. I don't know why Sorkin thinks this is so compelling, as if people don't hear other people speaking. Like, that's a big thing. hour. And he doesn't specify what he's talking about for a half hour. So you're like, what is hour? And then it has to be this big realization. Oh, and we get Sacha Baron Cohen. Oh, hey, fucking buddy. Hey, bro. Like, he goes, you meant if our blood is going to spill, let it flow all over the city. Or whatever. And then it's this big aha thing. And we set up that actually Abby is a secret genius who's been a big fan of Tom Hayden this whole time. He says, oh my God, I hate this. He says, he does this. It's a pattern. Read his portion of the Port Huron statement. He implies possessive pronouns and uses vague noun modifiers. Fuck you! God, there's so much wrong with this. Okay, here we go. The entire part of this is to sound smart. This is the entire point of this thing. This is the entirety of Aaron Sorkin. And the other point is to reveal that Abby has been secretly a super genius. But here's the thing. There is no Tom Hayden section of the Port Huron statement. The whole statement is written in a wee sentence. So like, he's saying that this is a pattern. The reason he said he left out the word R, the big crux of this is supposed to be that Eddie Redmayne, instead of saying if blood is going to spill, he meant to say if our blood is going to flow. But this is a pattern that Sacha Baron Cohen has noticed because he implies possessive pronouns and uses vague noun modifiers.
Okay, it's a pattern that transfers over to when you're talking out loud.
Yes.
Too?
That after your friend gets cracked in the head and is bleeding, that and when you would do an excited utterance in front of a crowd of people, that writing pattern that you've noticed in his section of the Port Huron statement would also make its way into your speech. It's so fucking stupid. Not only that, look at the Port Huron statement. I decided to do the research. The Port Huron statement has the word hour 100 billion times because it's written in the form of we. Here, I have some quotes from it. It starts out with, we are the people of this generation, bred in the least modest comfort, et cetera, et cetera. And they use the word hour 48 times in the document. As we grew, however, our comfort was penetrated, our common peril, our consciousness, literally. The fucking statement is written using the word hour 1,000 fucking times. But no, Abbie Hoffman is so smart that he's like, ah, I've noticed this, bro. Like, I noticed this about your writing. The vague noun modifiers and the implied pronouns. Yeah, this is a theme with him. Fuck! No, it's not! And it wouldn't comply to something that you were just shouting in the middle of a riot. Come the fuck on. Yeah. I hate it so much.
There's
I died.
There's a riot. He jumps riot. Up to the mic and he's like, whereas one's blood would whoops flow. No. Get the fuck out of here.
So if you want to know why I get so mad about this, this scene is the reason why. It's so fucking stupid.
Right.
Also, a noun modifier. You know what another word for a noun modifier is?
It's an adjective.
A fucking adjective.
Yeah.
But if he had said, wow, you use some vague adjectives sometimes, that wouldn't have sounded smart enough. You got to be like, oh, you vague noun modifiers. God. Fuck you. Okay, I'm done. I'm done. That's it.
But so now it ends.
By the way, a noun modifier. Vague noun modifier has nothing to do with not saying the word hour. It's like he just needed another thing to be part of the, oh, it's a pattern with him. Yeah, it's a pattern, bro. He implies possessive pronouns, which he objectively doesn't do. And he uses vague noun modifier. That has nothing to do with anything. God. Okay. I'm really done.
But that gets the grudging respect because, you know, our characters have to have an arc.
They've
here.
They reached an understanding.
And so Hayden says, let Abby testify. And you're like, leaving aside how
any
silly
of that.
Like right. And all of that is incredibly like you should not be testifying right now because you're gonna get destroyed and on cross examination. And Abby Hoffman actually does testify at the trial, but that's mm-hmm. because Thomas
He's
as
hilarious.
You alluded to yeah. at the beginning, right? That like they kind of had this circus atmosphere, right? They put
right.
Allen Ginsberg on yep. the stand to like chant Om, right?
Like yeah. Norman Mailer did weird poetry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why didn't they put any of that in the movie?
I don't know. It would have been so much more interesting. Like, you could have the exact same plot. You just compress some of the Langella stuff and you have them kind of realize early on. And so instead of the aha moment being, aha, we have the secret Ramsey Clark, or like,
yeah.
just have them go and be like, all right, well, the fix is in. So let's, you know, and then have Abby Hoffman like convince everybody like, well, if they're going to find us guilty no matter what, let's turn this into a fucking circus. Let's make this, you know, an act of revolution here in the courtroom. But like, it wouldn't have been hard to write that.
It's written. It's written in history books.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so just think about it. The fact that Abby Hoffman.
This might as well like hinge on the subjunctive case.
He
like,
doesn't have a section of the Port Huron statement. You're so fucking brilliant, Sorkin.
I just have to say, like, for all of the implied genius, like, the fact that Abby Hoffman figured out this pronoun usage, right? Like, does not mean that Abby Hoffman would be a good witness in a straight trial. Like, in a straight trial, Abby Hoffman would be a terrible fucking witness, right? Yeah. Like,
anyway. Okay, you would want to just put on Dellinger, wouldn't you? Wouldn't that be like the guy?
Yeah, Dellinger would be the move. But Abby Hoffman would be a great witness here, assuming you have a judge who keeps teeing him up for really good jokes, which he does here when Abby Hoffman takes the stand. It starts right away. He's like, okay, state your name. And Abby Hoffman's like, I have a great speech for that. I have a great speech about it. Okay, stop. You're Abby Hoffman. Got it. When were you born? Abby Hoffman's like, walked right into my trap, brah. Great speech for that, too. Great quips. All right, just lawyer go. And then finally go.
Yeah, the judge just gives up at a certain point. He's like, all right, I'll stop asking questions.
Taken from Abby Hoffman's actual testimony.
So. Yeah. Wait, does the judge ask you those establishing questions for some reason?
No. Seems like no.
Why did they do that? I don't know. All right. Get Frank Langella some more lines. Whatever.
That's fine.
Fair enough. Abby's testimony is great here, probably because the real guy was super funny. Like, he seems, I didn't even know anything about this guy, but he seems awesome after watching this.
Yeah.
You know, great subject matter here.
Have you not read Steal This Book?
Steal This Book.
Nope, I haven't. I should read it.
Oh, you should. Yeah, it's, you can steal it online. It's,
and in typical Sorkin, the Lincoln quote is real.
Yep.
He says, if Abraham Lincoln had given his speech about, you know, blah, blah, et cetera, et cetera, in 1968, he would have been charged with us. And you're like, great, awesome, that's super real. And then Sorkin's like, that's not enough. You know what he also needs to do? Quote fucking chapter and verse of the Bible for no fucking reason.
Okay.
Matthew 10, fucking 70, blah. That's, oh, God.
And you know who said that? Just a simple carpenter named Jesus Christ. It's such a dumb trope. And they use it.
So dumb. Here.
And not only that, but like the way in which they, and I've got to chime in with the bad law, right? The way in which they accomplish this is by having super lawyer Joseph Gordon-Levitt, right? Like, I mean, this is, he's been the only one who's on top of everything. And all of a sudden, now that Abby Hoffman is on the stand, he's got to ask like these idiotic open-ended questions and like hang around for the answers. And you're like, look, again, first year law students get told you don't ask open-ended questions on cross-examination. And like, you particularly don't do that when you have a fucking comedian on the stand, right?
Yeah, like, I was going to say, like, is there a class in law school that's here? Like, don't, here are the following one-liner setups to not say
When you are cross-examining and the witness asks you a question, do not answer it, okay?
Yeah, like, he starts asking him questions. I was like, well, who's on trial here? Like, what's going on?
Well, that's how they set up the Bible thing. They're like, you know, because Hoffman gives the, like, you know, I have come to set brother against sister. Do you know who said that? And you're like, well, fuck yeah. Like, it's one of the, like, eight most famous quotes from the Bible, right? Yeah. Like, but Joseph Gordon-Levitt is like, I don't know, Jerry Rubin. And you're like, oh, come the fuck on.
Yeah. Do you have anything else to add to your last answer, Abby Hoffman? I'm going to go with quip number two. Okay. Do you have contempt for your government?
Character is like, I'm going to describe some things about myself that are not particularly flattering, and you just go. You just react. You just give your thoughts.
Yeah, there is the question. He asks him, do you have contempt for your government? And the fact that he does not reply with the Transformers line of, I have nothing but contempt for my government. Like,
he does a variation, though.
Yeah, he does.
Not as much as my government has contempt for me, right? Wasn't that his
something
quip
like that
there? Yeah. And then Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's like, okay, you keep doing the quips. I feel like I'm going to tee up again. I'm going to ask you the same question again, and he gets another quip.
Yeah. It's so good. Quip me once, shame on me. Quit me twice. Yeah, whatever. Shame on
you. All right, you know what? Rule of threes. You're doing a set here. Well, one more time. You want to say One more answer to that. That's going to be funny.
Surely
I
can not get quipped on this next answer. This next one will be safe. Sacha Baron Cohen is like, okay, now pull my finger. He's like, well, I guess I pull your finger. There's no.
How could that possibly go wrong? Yeah. He's not going to have a quip there, I'm sure.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you got something on your shirt. What? I do. Oh, fuck. I can't. I can't not walk in. He's
looking. Here, have this cigar. Try it out. It definitely won't explode. Ah!
As Updog once said.
Yeah. He should have said that. You know where that was quoted? Updog, chapter 10, verse 35. What's Updog? Nothing much. What's up with you?
The court goes crazy.
Yeah.
You, sir, have infringed upon my BOFA rights.
This guy's so funny. Come on, innocent, right? Yeah, innocent.
So we Quentin Tarantino to after the verdict.
Which is described as trial day 157. Which is like, but then they walk out in prison get up and you're like, well, that's not the, that's right. Sentencing then, right? Isn't
that? Yeah. Correct. Right. And it's meant, and again, you know, the Breakfast Club clothes will show you that Rennie and the other, you know, the two most minor characters in the movie so far, were also acquitted. But like, instead, we've got to see them first. So we see the other five in prison garb and then, Rennie and what's his pal's name? Why am I blanking on that? Oh, no, it's not Rennie. It's Lee Wiener and John Froines. Sorry.
Yeah.
But again, it's who cares? There's a reason we haven't mentioned them by name in the previous 2 hours. So they're in civilian clothes, sitting in the gallery. They're setting up another thing we haven't talked to you about at all.
Yeah. Right? Which is not real. This is all made up by Sorkin.
Well, it's mostly made up. So Tom Hayden's buddy is Rennie Davis, right? That's the kid who gets the crap beat out of him. And,
McLovin.
McLovin.
Yeah, yeah. McLovin, right.
Is that actually McLovin or just look
it's
like
it's not.
Him?
I had to check. Yeah. I was like, no, it's not.
But he's been writing down on his legal pad the name of everybody who's died in Vietnam while this trial has been going on. And the trial really did take 5 months. So, but part of the reason it took 5 months is because the defense, you know, dragged it out. And so it's now sentencing and Judge Frank Langella looks over at Tom Hayden and is like, you know, I'm sure this is not going to bite me in the ass in any way whatsoever. But you, Tom Hayden, have been respectful and decent throughout. So, you know, if you say the words, I'm very, very sorry, as I turn the microphone over to you and shut off this. I'm going to turn on the switch that means I can't shut off your microphone.
Yeah.
And if you just say the words, I'm sorry, I will take that into consideration when I pronounce sentence.
By law, what could possibly go wrong? Get to give one speech at the end. I've decided it's you. Make it good. Be nice.
And they turn it over, and so it's the
and he does the make sure thing. Like he has to set it up even more. So, do I have you correct, Judge, that if I'm totally respectful, if I do no shenanigans of any kind, where I have no shenanigans, then my government will look favorably upon me? Just do I have that right? Do I have, before this big big crescendo moment? Do I have that right that I have to just buy the books? Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's correct. Right. This is going to be very serious. This will not backfire on me. You have that correct.
Private Jeffrey something, 20 years old, something. Like, okay. And we do this big, cheesy, inspirational, like TV commercial music. As he does, oh, Captain, my Captain.
Yeah.
And they all, oh, Captain,
stand
my Captain.
Up on the desks. Yeah.
God, it's
and
so
the judge
fucking dumb.
Obviously switched off the noise to his gavel also because he's banging it and he can't get anybody.
We get attention. This is so hacky. Sorkin decides, because he directed and wrote the thing, he decides that Judge Frank Langella will spend the final 5 minutes of the movie gaveling as hard as a judge could ever possibly. There will be order.
And remember, he's 108 at this time, right? Like,
yeah.
I just want you to picture like feeble old man attempting to gavel into order. None of this happens.
Yeah, as it zooms out, we see Frank Langella doing a full body motion into like 6 foot of motion in his gavel. Order! I'm the bad guy. Why aren't you listening to me? Order in this court.
He's just holding his hand up in the air like Thor's hammer gavel is going to land. Yep. Can't get any attention. It's the best. I got to be honest, though.
I was inspired. I cried a little bit during the scene when they're doing the reading and everybody's going nuts. Like I was emotional.
That's Sorkin for you.
He did it. He got
it's inspirational until you think about it for 2 seconds. And then you're like,
I choose not to think about
it. This didn't happen. That's okay. Seconds. It didn't happen. And then also we get the final, end of the character arc that was pointless the entire time, which is Joseph Gordon-Levitt stands up. The other cartoon bad guy, prosecutor's like, what are you doing? And he's like, showing respect for the fallen. And he stands up. Like, cool. Well, that really didn't matter at all. The fact that
you're still a bad guy.
Still, yeah, didn't matter. Never mattered.
Yeah.
I got to say, when we do the Breakfast Club close, the fact that Bobby Seale was found to be falsely accused of murder in 1968, how badly falsely accused must that have been? Like, if you could not falsely accuse a Black Panther of killing a guy in 1968, like, you must have really staged that murder badly, is all I'm saying. Like that, I'm pretty sure you could convict a Black man in 1968 of any murder. Like, just that's how racist our country was. Like, if he was nearby or not nearby, it'd be like guilty. But to have been found innocent and falsely accused in 1968, I wonder what a sham that accusation must have been. It must have been real bad.
Just Bobby Seale getting indicted and a ham sandwich walking out being like, ha! That's funny because normally this is the saying is that I would, nope, just you. So weird.
Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, well, again, the movie misses out. It says Kunstler got, 23 different contempt charges, which is true. Everybody, right? Both defense lawyers and all of the defendants got years of sentencing for contempt handed down. All of that reversed on appeal. But, it just seems real weird, not to say that in your movie where it would kind of underscore your point about that judge. I don't know. I didn't get that one.
Well, all the contempt stuff and the charges, but that all got reversed because of the impassioned soliloquy at the end. Right? That's how court works.
So actually, I did have a question. So is that something that always happens, or wouldn't those contempt charges be a separate thing from the trial? Or is it like the Seventh Circuit, when they granted this appeal or whatever you call it, does that also wipe away the contempt stuff automatically, or is that a separate thing?
Yeah, you have to appeal that separately. And again, the reason the contempt charges add up as opposed to, being imposed at the time is because, you've got the right as a defendant to, be there. So, they're adding up. But I mean, when I pulled up, Kunstler had 4 years worth of contempt charges against him. Weirdly, Abby Hoffman only got 8 months, right?
Well, because he wasn't.
He was funny.
Contrary to contrary to the movie, he wasn't doing fucking roast comedy the entire trial. Some of the stuff he did was he blew a kiss, which they did portray, but that was one of the extremes that he went to was the blown of a kiss. He wasn't, constantly doing a fucking routine. But it would have been interesting to capture, and I have to imagine this would have been pretty high stakes for the attorneys and whatever to be facing real time because of this nuts old racist piece of shit judge. That must have been stressful as hell to be like, this is all a sham, but we could go to prison for real time here, right? I mean,
yeah.
All right. Well, Heath, any closing thoughts on this movie?
I loved it. I loved Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
And Abby Hoffman's awesome. Abby Hoffman was right.
Abby Hoffman's awesome. I'll try to extend an olive branch. It was an enjoyable movie. Aaron Sorkin did some good stuff. The stuff he did that was bad was so insulting to my intelligence that I have a violent reaction to it. And I get it. That's a me thing. That's fine. That's a me thing. But I fucking
hate
it.
You mean an hour thing? Thomas, you do that a lot.
Yeah.
You use different pronouns. I've read all your essays.
Not a terrible movie. Just some really, really terrible parts.
The law in this movie is real bad.
The law is real bad. The history is super fascinating, though. I just would have loved to see this in somebody else's hands. If somebody wrote this movie not trying to just prove how smart they are and actually trying to do a movie, would have been cool. I would have enjoyed that.
Didn't Kunstler give an amazing actual speech in real life at the end that they didn't use?
Yes.
What? I don't understand. I don't know. Sorkin was like, I'm gonna do quips with Abbie Hoffman. It's gonna be bad.
I'm gonna do a dramatic reading of the deaths in Vietnam that didn't actually happen. Apparently, they tried to get that read into the record, like at some point in the trial, I think, right, Andrew? But yeah.
And like they got predictably, it was like in the middle of the trial, it was on the anniversary of some important date in the Vietnam War. And predictably, they got like four names in.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the judge was like, I actually do have a gavel and the power to shut off your microphone. And I'm going to do that right here.
I know. As if he wouldn't just be like, stop. And then they'd stop. Or or let's pretend he doesn't have the power to stop him. He'd just be like, all right, peace out. Bye. Like you'd just still be like, order in the court for an hour.
Goes over to the light switch like a teacher, flicks him on and off. Yeah.
Well, Heath, thanks so much for coming on. I thought it'd be good balance to have somebody who loves Sorkin to keep me honest. Fair enough. Feel like we've solved a lot here.
You know, happy to be here. Just watch those vague noun modifiers.
Yeah, I'm gonna say I'm happy to be the Eddie Redmayne to your fucking Abbie Hoffman, or vice versa. I don't know which would be. But
it's thanks. All both, right?
Thanks for taking the time, and of course, find Heath over at God Awful Movies. New York Times fucking Academy Award winning podcast Skeptocrat.
Listen,
by the way,
listen, I'm just a regular person like you guys. It's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. It's a local paper called the New York Times. It's in New York. Yeah.
How is that just unbelievable fame and fortune gone for you?
I can't even go on the street anymore. It's really hard. It's hard, honestly. I have a difficult life now.
And the Scathing Atheist. Let's see. We got D&D Minus. Oh, there's one. Citation Needed. Is that all of them?
I think you nailed them.
I nailed them. Okay. Thanks so much. Great shows. Everybody check them out if you aren't already, which I'm sure you are. And thanks, patrons. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.